Hi, and welcome to Backstage at Architects Insight 2010. It's day two, and we've just come away from the keynote sessions, and it's a great pleasure to have Dave Copeland with me. So Dave, you are working in public sector primarily, and you talked about the open government. So I guess kind of a start off a 10, open government, what's this?
What is that? Yeah, thanks, Matt. First of all, thanks for having me backstage. Great to be here. The open government principle is all about how do we change the way that public services are both delivered and consumed, and it's really at its heart is about putting the citizen at the centre of those services. Typically, public service has been something that is done to people, and if it's not, it certainly feels that way. This is about how do we put the citizen at the heart in both the creation and the delivery of the service. It's something that's I think been born out of the recession. Mm-hmm. I think it also is to do with the whole concept of consumerization of IT. So IT is, it's a part of modern society today, and that's not to dispute challenges around the digitally excluded. But we now have and we use IT as a natural part of our everyday life. And I think what's happened is government, both local and central, has seen that there is some benefit in really empowering citizens using technology to, in particular, be part of the way that they subscribe to, consume and deliver services.
So I understand. I can understand from what you're saying. Open government. That's the result or the aspiration. What's the cause? What is it? Why do it? You said recession. That's one thing. Who's driving it? I guess is it government initiative, and why are they? Who are they responding to?
I think there are two sides to that to that answer. One is, I think government is driving it, and I think there's a part of government that sees this in a very fluffy, it's the right thing to do kind of way, and wouldn't it be great if we lived in a democracy where everybody was engaged and empowered.
That's good to hear. Is this the politician saying
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's the politician saying that.
That's good to hear,
it. Absolutely. But, bluntly, it's the recession. We're at a point now where we're taking anywhere between 20 and 50% out of public spending. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a big number. And the only way you can make that kind of saving and not drastically remove service or destroy the way services are delivered is you transform the way in which services are provided and consumed. Mm-hmm. And that kind of leads you to the same conclusion as the fluffy, we want people to be engaged and empowered, because actually if the citizen's more engaged and empowered, actually I can provide services in a very different way. Maybe I don't need a 100 people call centre, maybe I just need a 10 person call centre, and then I've got a different range of options for how the citizen might consume or direct services. Maybe there are different things we can do by connecting different services. So, the example I talked about this morning was the waste refuse. Maybe if I've always got capacity in my recycle bin, maybe I can sell that either back to the council for a refund on my council tax, or I can sell it to my neighbour who's always got more recycle than he's got blue boxes for. And there's some kind of trade that happens. All of these things get enabled. And so really it's the two things. It's the fluffy side, so getting people engaged in democracy. And it's the hard side, which is, this stuff will save us money. Treasury report into what would we do if we opened up data and we had more transparent processes across government? £6 billion. Yeah. That's a big sum of money and goes a long way to some of the savings that we've got to make.
So that's public sector. I guess this should translate into private sector, which are pretty good at hoarding their data and information. What would be $6 billion for government? Would it be more or less if private sector was able to unleash this power of information or data?
I'd love to say, and this is completely off the cuff, I actually think it would be more. And the reason for which it would be more, I think there are two sides with what you could do with private sector data. The public data in private sector, if you understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That should actually be out there in the public domain. And the kind of rule of thumb that we use is that if I can get that information as a result of a Freedom of Information request, it's kind of public data. So don't make me go and make the request. Mm. Put it out there and let me do interesting things with it. And then the second thing is a lot of private sector organizations have got really brilliant data that they could charge money for. So what if we had a framework or mechanism where we could put those data sets, make them available through a standard open API, and then really monetize the access to that data? Think of some of the mapping stuff or some of the record stuff that people have paid a lot of money to generate, satellite imagery, for example, and then want to be able to pass that cost on or sell that on to people who would consume it. So I think there's a huge potential for what you can do in the private sector as well.
Yeah. I mean, what I often come across in terms of the people I engage with is somewhat of a blanket view to data policies, and government I would have put in that category, and it's clear that they're kind of splitting it up. They're making decisions without, and I remember you saying open, you know, things should be open by default until you can prove they need to be private.
Yeah.
So I guess that applies, well, equally to the private sector, because there's policies are put in place that suddenly cover all situations. And what you're saying, you've got to actually have grades of levels of privacy or something like that. How would you go about that?
Well, there's a whole range of work that needs to be done around information assurance. Mm. And you know what, funnily enough, the cloud's going to drive a lot of that as well. You know, one of the barriers I think we see a lot with people, you know, looking to embrace the cloud is they kind of don't know where their data's at today. Mm. Yes, they've got a rough idea, but, you know, are they really confident that they know that the bits that are marked restricted actually are restricted, or the bits that are marked public actually are public? Mm. So we've kind of got to get really, really smart about information assurance, and it's about agreeing with the business some levels of, you know, and whether it's, you know, using the public sector, you know, top secret, secret, restricted, confidential, that sort of thing, or it's just, you know, public, private. Doesn't really matter in an organisation.
There's a level above that that I'm just sort of struck with is the guarantee or the single version of the truth. You know, how can you guarantee? You know, financial services and banking, they spend, must be millions certainly, if not more, on cleaning data and deduping, and you know, one person's data is somebody else's is out of date data.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, how are we going to actually sort of ensure that there's at least a quality, so I can rely on that data.
There are sort of, I guess, two approaches that I take with that. One is that the process of opening data up makes it a lot more transparent. So if I can see the data, then actually I can see the fact that the records are wrong, or that there's, you know, garbage in the data and all that sort of stuff. Secondly, you know, the process of publishing that stuff forces you to put that data into, you know, a better format. So if I'm going to make some stuff that's going to be available publicly, for example, you know, just going through that process, I will clean that data up. It's a bit like, the analogy I use is, you know, when we all went off on the enterprise architecture crusade, it was like, right, we're going to do enterprise architecture, right, we're going to do it to you. And actually, we kind of never did enterprise architecture to anybody. Mm. Enterprise architecture wasn't about, and this is the cliche bit, you know, wasn't about a destination. It was about the journey. Mm. You know, we learn as an organisation.
I think the problem was it was seen as a destination.
Absolutely.
I guess away. Like everything else, it's, I need one of those. It's clouds happening at the moment. I need the cloud.
Exactly.
Okay, now what should we use it for?
Yeah, and the same is true of data. It's like, you know, I don't think there is any such thing as perfect data, as perfectly clean data. You're always going to have some sort of problems. The other part of this is, you know, what if you transferred the ownership of the data? So again, something that, you know, we're talking about a lot about in public sector but applies equally in private sector is, what if you take the ownership of the data away from the organisation and put it in the hands of the individual? So let me give you an example. If I have a record that has my name and address in, and I then allow the banks to access that data to use it, or my insurance company to see that data, rather than every insurance company, you know, so how many insurance policies have you got? You got your home insurance, your car insurance, all that sort of stuff. Well, that's a separate definition of each, you know, instance of your data. Mm. If I've only got one and I allow each of those companies to subscribe to that data, that's kind of the single version of the truth. Mm. It's transparent, so I can see into it, I can see that the data's wrong or whatever. But most importantly, I've made an explicit decision to allow those companies to consume it. So it gets us a long way there, so we have a single version of the truth, but it also changes the privacy dynamic as well, so it becomes my data rather than the organisation.
And you use the Microsoft Health Vault as an example.
It's a perfect example of that.
And as I listened to that, and I didn't know the details of Health Vault, you know, I've heard the brand name and whatever, so that really excited me, because you know, it was a different way to view what that was all about. But underlying that, it just reminded, this is the whole sort of Kim Cameron's view on identity. So, you know, the his laws of identity, it's user in control, user always a part of the transaction, and all those sort of things. So does this directly link to the work in the identity space, or is it just a happen chance? Or
No.
Is it by design?
I'd love to say it's by design, and I'm sure if you
It's using the same principles, clearly.
Yeah, if you go down deep enough, you'll find the connection. Mm. But for me, it's about those architectural principles, and I think it's this transference that we're seeing, driven by things like consumerization. So computing is no longer the special thing that I do at work or in a place of education. I kind of do it everywhere. And it now affords us the ability to put that, the burden, if you like, onto the individual. And that's a good place to be, because then when the individual's informed and empowered, you can make much better decisions because you know and it's transparent. So those principles become really, really important, that you put the user in control, and also that you make them cognizant of, you know, what's going on, what's happening. There's an audit trail. You can see there's transparency.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the link back to the whole identity piece is fundamental, because, you know, the internet, the whole process has no identity currently. And, and you know, that has to happen in order that this data can be liberated and shared.
Yeah, exactly. And
certainly your personal data. And you need to be in control of who sees what.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
You know, so that's fantastic. Now, there's another thing that you talked about, the Copernican
shift.
Right, and what's really interesting for me, and all the way through Insight, it's been a fantastic example of convergent thinking, and I'm sure it's not just the people here, it's actually because it underlies this shift.
Yeah.
And yesterday was about architecting today.
Yeah.
You know, what are the tools and techniques and problems that architects face today, and today is about architecting for tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'd fully expected for us to talk about these sort of things today, but everybody yesterday was effectively saying, you know, talking about or demonstrating that there is a clear platform, a tangible platform that enables this shift.
Yeah.
So I guess it would be good to kind of get your take on the shift and what that means.
Yeah.
And then just explore that a bit further.
Well, you know, it's funny because the shift to me is about a number of things. That it's sort of at its highest level, this is about putting the citizens right at the heart of everything that goes on in public sector, or the customers if you're in private sector, or partners, or however you want to view it. And excuse me. And a lot of it's about confidence. You know, if you build a baseline architecture or service that you're confident that the customer, citizen can use, can do different things, and you're just confident with how that's going to work, then you're in a really strong position to enable and encourage innovation on that platform. If you want to control the service and lock it down, then actually you constrain everything that can be done, and you treat the people who use the service, in my mind, you treat them like idiots. You treat them in a stupid way. So this shift is about having confidence in the platform that you provide, that the person that you want at the heart of the system of the service is going to be able to do anything that they want, is really going to be able to pull bits of data, bits of applications, to deliver the service that's relevant to them, or to create a product that's relevant to them. Mm. And that shift is really about that shift of confidence for me, you know, at a lower level. And we've seen it happen. We've seen it happen in enterprise IT, right? So, you know, we've gone from locking down the desktop to actually we're going to provide you with a baseline. To a certain extent, you can kind of do what you want when you plug into the network. We'll put you through quarantine, make you sure you're patched and all that sort of stuff. Fundamentally,
I see there's a lot of talk on this. And yet to see, I mean, you know, certainly in the banking sector,
maybe
it's gone completely the other way.
We're getting there. But it's about turning this around. And I think, you know, that's the bit that we've got to do, is we've got to open this up, and we've got to bring people inside our organisations. And when we do that, I think really, you know, wonderful things will happen. It's one of these, you know, it's almost an emotional leap of faith, right? It's a bit like connecting lots of disparate data sets. Nobody knows what will happen when you do that, but we just...
It's the synergism of that. Exactly. It's just the explosive effect of liberating that data, and it just fits the value chain, and it creates innovation and new opportunities.
Oh, exactly. You know, and to me, from an architectural level, funnily enough, it's an evolution of the journey that we've been on around, you know, service-oriented architecture, enterprise architecture. In public sector, the thing right now is talking about government as platform. So you shift the role of government from being the owner of the service, I'm going to do it to you, to being the orchestrator of the service. So here's a platform, here's some app fragments or some data. Fill your boots.
Yeah.
And I know that's, you know, a bit of a theoretical sort of lovey approach, but actually, you know, that, you know, as architect, isn't that really what we're about empowering people to use technology in that way? That to me is the journey that I think, you know, that's the next step of where we've got to go.
So look, Dave, I know you're a bit of a troublemaker, and so I mean, where should people go and have a look at next. The reason why I say you're a troublemaker is I know you have a great site that is worth plugging, because I certainly follow it, and I think others should be aware. So where should we go to follow your journey in disruptive government and find out what's happening? And the other thing was, you mentioned a date in May, and whether that's an election date or something. You mentioned something in parallel with that.
Yeah.
So
I'd like to touch on that. So two things. You know, what we're trying to do with all of this stuff, and you're right, actually, to term it as the journey. So the journey that I think we're on is all sort of chronicled on the Envisioners. So that's www.theenvisioners.com. And there you'll find the slides from today. In a week or so, you'll find the video as well. So you can see the session.
You might even find this interview.
You may even find this interview.
One day in the future,
exactly.
If we like it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. And you can point and laugh and
well, we'll
and,
do a lot
and
of
pass
that.
Judgment. So, but the other thing, I think, you know, if you know, the test for the UK is going to happen around our general election, I think. And what's interesting is both, you know, there are two major parties in the UK who are, you know, in real contention for being the major part of government come May the 7th, which is when the election, the day after the election is. And I think the test for us is we're talking about open government today as a key part of the election battleground. You know, it's important, and it's important to both parties. So if we want to really see whether open government can happen, then I think watch the UK from May and probably throughout the summer. Give it 3 months, because I think that there are some big changes are being proposed by both of those parties that will really seek to push the boundaries of what's possible, fueled by the need to make massive savings in public spending. I mean, let's not kid ourselves.
Yes.
But, you know, I think we are probably at the most critical point in terms of what technology can do to transform the way service is delivered.
I we could stop there, but I just really like what you're saying right at the end there, because coming out of this recession, if that's what's happening, and who knows, and with not a change of government, but with an election, and with this, all parties sort of having this in their manifestos, is a great opportunity, and probably won't get a better opportunity to see the empowerment and freedom of information coming out from government to enable this transformation.
Yeah.
And I think what's really interesting, and this is general feeling I get, is it's yes, everybody needs to be saving money and cutting costs, but it's with an innovation agenda attached, and that is very mature way to deal
with
this situation.
Exactly. You know, I really feel this is, and I know it's a bit sort of cliched, but this is outcome focused. You know, we're not just going in there. You know, if they wanted to save 20%, it's quite easy how you save 20%. You just stop doing a bunch of stuff. You can't do that. You know, so I think it's that pressure is the right kind of dynamic tension to really to make true innovation happen, not just incremental, you know, evolution. I mean, fundamental transformation to the way services are delivered. And I just the stage is set. We just have to see how it's all going to play out now.
Oh, fascinating, and to see government on the front foot.
Well, exactly.
I mean,
how bizarre is that?
What are we talking about? You know, this is crazy.
You know, I am convinced that we are going to see more transformation and innovation in the public sector than we have probably seen in the private sector for the last 5 years. And that, to me, you know, what kind of a crazy world are we living in? But that's the way it is. You know?
That's fascinating. So, watch this space. Or keep in touch with the Envisioners.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Brilliant. So, thanks, Matt.
Yeah,
thanks a lot.
No, good to talk to you.